Now what are you doing? I hear some scratching.
Oh, sorry. Playing with a piece of paper.
Don't play with a piece of paper, Toby.
Sorry.
How this is going to have your ass.
This is all falling apart.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is...
more like Ancient Aliens.
Yeah. Yeah, that is your version of either Agatha Christie or some kind of adorable, scampy chimney sweep who's gotten herself into a spot of trouble.
Yeah.
Involving UFOs, Governor.
There's UFOs in the air.
I am impressed that you pulled that accent off. I did not know the level of your thespian skills.
That's about the extent of it right there.
Yeah. You could be a spy.
I could be a spy, 100%.
Toby, this is more like Ancient Aliens. With you and me, we are a podcast about the popular, seemingly endless, or in this case, the seemingly bottomless and sprawling underground world of the History Channel show Ancient Aliens. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds, a journalist who has seen a manor house from afar, but not been invited inside.
And I'm Toby Ball. I was a creator of Strange Arrivals on iHeart Television. I mean, podcasts.
That is incredible. And I look forward to you doing that the entire program. Today, we are looking at Mystery of Rudlow Manor. That's season 12, episode 3. And I think the real mystery of Rudlow Manor is how many times our beloved and trusted producer, Heather Eagle Ears Wilson, is going to add a thunderclap behind the title. This is ominous.
That's classy stuff.
Yeah. On the one hand, I was a little disappointed that it wasn't quite as ghostly and as murderous as the title would have you believe. But then, you know, it more than made up for it with ley lines and underground tunnels and all kinds of crazy stuff. Let's get into it. This episode, Toby, first aired May 12th, 2017. Number of other things of great import happened on this date. One was that there was a huge international cyber attack. You may remember this, the WannaCry ransomware program. Disrupted computer systems across 99 countries. 400,000 computers. Ooh. Exposing all kinds of vulnerabilities in our cyber infrastructure. The other thing that happened was former One Direction singer Harry Styles released his self-titled debut solo album.
I know that one song. Was it Sunflower? Is that the one?
You're going
to
sing
it? I think my youngest listens to that sometimes.
And are you going to sing it for us?
I'm not, Governor.
Why are we covering this episode? Why are we covering...
I don't know. It's a good question.
Mystery of Rudlow Manor. The reason is because Britain can have Roswells too. And I think if you think about it, the thesis is really that fancy English manors have basements. And basements have secrets. And sometimes, Toby, those secrets... are UFOs. So let's get into it.
All right.
The year is London. The place is 2007.
Nice.
The British Ministry of Defense says it's going to release all of these UFO files that it has compiled into the National Archives. It does so. Now, a guy named Andrew Russell opines that, I thought that his argument was a little strange, but he jumps right into it. Says, you know, the Ministry of Defense, they're trying to cut costs from all of these people doing public records requests, asking all of these questions. So the best way to presumably conceal some great big conspiracy is just to release all the files to the public. So the Brits can continue to be interested, but not show that they're interested. So it's this very, like, it's a very British answer. You know, it's very like,
we
are notoriously emotionally cauterized. We can't show our feelings about how interested we are in UFOs. So we'll just put that stuff out there and kind of peek over our teacups at it. Is that the impression you got?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about this later. I think the reality was, is that they kind of knew there was nothing there. So it's like, well, why don't we just put it out there and people can look for themselves and find nothing.
Okay, we'll talk about it later. But the important thing, at least according to the show, is that 18 files were missing. And really the takeaway from this early segment, before we're even getting to any kind of manner, is there's some fun B-roll of somebody throwing papers into a furnace, suggesting that there is a cover-up.
Yeah, I'm not sure that major government offices actually get rid of their records by burning them in furnaces, but maybe. I also had some questions. Aren't there 18 missing minutes in the Watergate tapes?
Oh, you think there's a correlation?
And then there's 18 missing files. So I don't know if it's just sort of a numerology thing or whether like 18 sprung to mind when they were trying to make up a conspiracy. Something that would... Anyway, that just kind of popped out at me while I was listening.
Yeah, it's a number that is random enough to seem specific, but not too big. You know, if you're like, there's 31,914 pages. Well, you can't remember that. So you're just going to round up. But 18.
Yep.
Anyway, the twist, Toby, is that though these files were missing, they found them. They sent them to the National Archives. But then in a convoluted twist of fate, they were kept under lock and key. And then they were supposedly evacuated from this place to be taken to a more secure place. Did that all track for you?
Nope. Okay. It seemed completely ridiculous, but it was a way of introducing Rudlow Manor.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, they don't even say they definitely took these 18 files to Rudlow Manor. They said maybe.
Could be.
They took them to Rudlow Manor. So now we get to the meat of this episode, which is really kind of the first time that we have encountered architecture porn in this program. I mean, I guess anytime we're looking at ancient ruins.
Pyramids.
I guess that's all technically architecture porn.
I mean, it's all eras.
Have you been to any English manors or any kind? I'll take any kind.
Any English manors or any kind of manors? Mm-hmm. Does Versailles count?
Yeah.
Versailles recently. That's a big ass manor.
I mean, that's a palace, but sure.
Well, yeah, it's... Yeah, I don't know if I've actually been to like a like proper English manor. If I did, it would have been like when I was a sophomore in high school, but I don't recall it.
It's very specific.
Well, we went to Europe between my sophomore and junior year in high school.
Yeah.
And I was in England, but I don't remember going to a manor.
Yeah. I have never been to an English manor. I would say of all of the rich people houses in Europe, the English manor is probably the least interesting to me in a general way. I mean, in Spain, you have like the Alhambra, you have all of this Moorish influenced architecture. In France, as you mentioned, there's Versailles, which is just ostentatious as hell. But you would love to see, wouldn't you love to see the UFOs that were kept under Versailles?
Yeah, Versailles. So when I was there, which was 2.5-3 years ago, it is now like a great place for Instagram people to take pictures in these like super extravagant, like gold plated walls and stuff. It was actually pretty annoying. But strangely, I think sort of in keeping with the general attitude for the people who were actually in Versailles at the time when it was at its peak, like it seemed like Louis XIV might have been like a pretty good Instagram influencer if that had been what was going on back then.
Yeah, you can think of Louis XIV as the originator of Le Thirst Trap.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
Yeah.
So,
fantastic.
Yeah, that was a little weird.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have anything to do with aliens.
No. And as far as I could tell from this episode, neither does this episode. But they tried.
Like,
they really tried.
Maybe a little bit.
No, okay. So Rudlow Manor from the outside looks like a sort of boring, drab, rain-soaked rich person's home. Underneath it, we find out 2.2 million square feet of tunnels and chambers, which you think, all right, I'm into it. Dug out in the 18th century by people who were digging out what was called the bath stone, because it was stone that was then shipped nearby to the town of Bath and several other English cities to build it. So they were just digging it out. And then at some point they stuck a manor on top of it, but the tunnels yet remained, which of course is great for us because we always love an underground version of alien stuff.
I'm not sure, like I'm generally unclear about whether English manors in general have a lot of underground stuff. Like, did you see The Gentleman on Netflix? Mm-hmm. It was like a Guy Ritchie thing.
Yeah.
And it's all about how they have a big marijuana growing operation in the tunnels underneath the manor. I don't know if that was a thing or not.
Then I guess there are a lot of tunnels.
Well, at least these two.
Yeah, what if this was that, where
the whole thing's just weed?
Yeah, the whole thing's just weed. Aliens are down there just growing weed.
Alien weed.
Hell yeah.
Nice. All right. That's the best of all worlds.
It would be wild, man. So it becomes a manor. The tunnels remain. During World War II, course, England goes to war with Germany, allegedly, and the Royal Air Force takes over the manor and uses these chambers to build planes of war, as I call them. Some people call them war planes. I call them planes of war. It's a good place to do it, safe. And of course, this will call back to our previous episode about Werner von Braun and how he was building rockets in tunnels over there. Yep. So maybe that's a connection. At least that's one that I thought of.
And Suzanne Rico's grandfather.
And Suzanne Rico's grandfather. Absolutely. It was Werner von Braun. Okay, so after the war, what's called the Provost and Security Services holds on to it, which is a very fancy, stuck-out pinky version of, like, the security services, you know, CIA kind of a thing. It's described as sort of the James Bond branch. Now they do terrorist investigations, but it comes out in the 1990s that they were doing investigations on UFOs, which, you know, all the security services are always looking at stuff that was in the sky. Maybe they care about UFOs, maybe they don't. It's always nice to know if something's flying over your airspace. Maybe you want to identify what it is. So this is season 12. We know that the show is really cooking. They've got money, so that means that they get to take a field trip out here to take a look at it. And I want to get your opinion on this, that some of those opportunities were sort of squandered. Like Giorgio Tsoukalos goes there, and as we'll see, he looks at some stuff. He has a pint in the pub. But by and large, you kind of feel like, I think he was using this as a vacation opportunity. The drama around when they first show the manor now is, why are the grounds surrounded by chain link fences and cameras? And, says the narrator, even protected by guard dogs. Like, they're really leaning into the idea that you wouldn't fortify a place for just no reason.
Yeah, especially when a bunch of UFO nuts think there's UFOs underneath it. Like, that wouldn't lead you to...
Yeah.
Put up a fence.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing that Tsoukalos doesn't really have much of the eye of the tiger when it comes to trying to penetrate these defenses. Like, he basically walks up to the fence and admits defeat, and the cops come and tell him he's got to go. He's like, all right, I'm out of here. But Nick Pope doesn't even make it out of his car.
No, we're going to talk about Nick Pope in a minute.
He's like, I think my background is, I'm not the kind of person who should be walking around this fence. The most sort of interesting part of this whole ridiculous episode is we get to see that Tsoukalos has this like interesting man bag that he's carrying around that he has again and again and again, but never seems to, like, he never really goes for anything that's in it. And as a matter of fact, I'm not sure what he could be carrying in that bag that would be of any use to him during any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I was somewhat hoping maybe he had like some like dog treats, like they do in some of those things where you distract the dogs, you like dog treats with sedatives in them or something so that he could get through there. I thought maybe there's going to be some cloak and dagger, but it's not what happens. He retreats to the car, a little freaked out, but trying to play it cool.
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about this place?
This is private property. Okay. It is well signposted. Okay. As you come down the road, it's private property.
I would love to see the fabricated B-roll where it's the actual Tsoukalos approaching the fence, and then there's a very obvious cut where it's a stuntman dressed just like him,
yeah,
who then does some like parkour over the fence, runs, dodges the guard dogs. And it's dressed like him. It's obviously a taller and leaner person, but the giveaway is that they've given him a wig that looks like Tsoukalos' wig.
Then the next scene is like some soundstage in Burbank.
Yes.
Made to look like the inside of Rudlow Manor.
Yeah.
I made it. I got past the guard dogs.
Yeah.
Either that or just the guy gets taken down by the guard dogs.
Yeah.
Next scene is Tsoukalos coming back with his clothes and tatters.
Yeah.
Nick Pope's just like, oh man, he should stay in the car.
Told you. I warned you.
Yep.
So yeah. So he meets Nick Pope and it feels like we're sort of getting to know some of these talking heads. I mean, in that they're actually out in the real world. It's sort of invigorating to be like, ah, Nick Pope out in his homeland. What do we know about Nick Pope, Toby? What can you tell us about?
So Nick Pope did work for the Ministry of Defense in England. His portfolio was sort of the UFO thing. Like, he's one of those guys who, you know, will talk about stuff, but won't be very specific about it. It's just like, oh, if you'd seen the stuff I'd seen. I interviewed him for Strange Arrivals about Rendlesham Forest, which we'll talk about in a little bit. super nice guy, very generous with his time, very personable. I don't know quite what his deal is, whether he's like sort of a sincere believer or whether, you know, it's a way of kind of turning his previous experience into something that's sort of monetizable. He sometimes pops up on Ancient Aliens talking about weird stuff that doesn't seem like the sort of stuff you'd be an expert in if you were working for the Ministry of Defense. So anyway, I think he's kind of an interesting character, but he's definitely willing to, like, I think he says at one point that what's behind the fence is like obviously important if they're sending security out to keep you out of there, which again, I mean, I think they say that it's supposed to be data processing for the British Navy, which isn't super sexy, but again, it's probably something you just don't want random people wandering into.
Why would the Royal Navy want to preserve its data or protect its data? Well, you might want a fence.
There are fences with barbed wire around like the 5 snowplows that some towns in New Hampshire have. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just like the lowest form of security you can find.
Yeah.
There's a great, great moment where Tsuklos is getting shown the being escorted out by security. And he says,
"Well, we're only trying to find out the truth.
We're only trying to find out the truth."
Yeah. This in response to the British cop asking the most British cop way he can.
"I'm asked the million dollar question. What are you doing down here?"
Wonderful.
"We're trying to find out the truth." Oh, okay.
"We're trying to find out the truth." And then right before he gets shunted off back to meet Nick Pope, it's just absolutely adorable because you do get to see a nice shot in through the fence at the entrance to the facility, which is kind of like what I would imagine would look like a hobbit hole if the hobbit was a doomsday prepper. Like there's a little sort of ramp down and then like a fortified concrete door. And it's all built into this very adorable rolling green hill. And then next to, you know, this is what's the most ominous thing, next to this door is a bike rack with a couple of bikes in it. Incredible.
<That's right.
laughs> Incredible. I mean, just those touches. That's what makes it.
I actually had a boss who lived in a house that was inside a hill.
Man, that's cool.
You'd like open a door, and it's like a door into a hill, and you like go in, and it was an underground house, and it had like round rooms, like the rooms were round. There was a pool in the living room, and then like on the back side of it, there was like a huge window, so you could see the stream that went by. Everybody called it the Hobbit House. It's just a little weird. Like you walk into a room that's round, it feels like you're on Starship Enterprise or something, but it's kind of an interesting spot. Again, not much to do with aliens as far as I know.
No, but that does sound like a hell of a place that you would store aliens. I mean, you know, that's every bit as interesting as Rudlow Manor. And Rudlow Manor, of course, has a mystery attached to it.
I didn't know if there were any millions of feet of underground caverns or anything. But
yeah,
I think these digressions are sort of an indication of, I think, the general interest level in this episode.
Think of the digressions not as us losing the thread, but more like the underground tunnels and burrows. They're all interesting. They open onto these passages. You never know exactly where you're going to go. And they've been carved out of the living earth by 19th century stonemasons to build the city of Bath, except we're building the city of Bath of the mind.
Yep, isn't that helpful? It's all a big metaphor.
All right, so Tsuklos and Pope, tail between legs, slink on back to the town. They go to a pub, and that's where we learn what makes this part of the world interesting. From Andrew Collins, we find out that, per him, they've got UFOs there. Of course, they've got crop circles.
Yep.
They got a bunch of prehistoric sites, ancient mounds, Toby, burrows, some stone circles that are supposedly 10,000 years old.
Avebury, Stonehenge.
Yeah. So admittedly, it's a pretty interesting part of the world.
It's all going on.
It's what Collins calls window areas. And supposedly they have seen UFOs descend and land in these stone circles, which makes sense. But, you know, they start to build the argument in that oblique way that Ancient Aliens does, where it's like, well, if all of this crazy old stuff is here and it's got these mystical connections, maybe the UFOs know it. Maybe that's why the British military decided to use it as a place for their alien files and whatever other stuff, because they knew that it was sort of a magic place, which relies on the British government knowing about the significance of ley lines and earth grids, which we find out is a concept introduced in the Alfred Watkins book, The Old Straight Track, which is just an adorable name. What's a ley line, Toby?
It's a good question, Brandon. I was hoping you would have looked it up.
No. Yeah, ley lines are, if you look at a globe, you can draw lines from place to place and you can sort of connect them because there's enough stuff in the world that you can make any kind of geometric shape you want. It really is a little bit of the pareidolia, seeing faces in clouds. But supposedly these ley lines, if you look at places where whatever qualifies for mystic phenomena of whatever type around the world happens, you can draw these lines that connect them, which I think is just what happens in a geographic space. Like you can draw a line that connects things. Nevertheless, Watkins contends in his book, The Old Straight Track, that these lines that definitely exist are actually magnetic fields. And Tsoukalos helpfully chimes in, says, yeah, you can draw a line from where we are in England to the tip of the boot of Italy. And then a map pops up on screen and shows the towns that it supposedly passes through this magic line. And he says,
all these cities, they contain the root word for star.
In other words, they're all sort of named for the star. But I didn't find that to be the case. I mean, I looked up one, Khaleesi, which apparently the root of that is dog. Or also a Dothraki princess, depending on which religious tradition you follow.
You know, it's another one of those things where they kind of make claims but don't offer any examples at all. Like, you could have thrown out, like, names of three towns.
Nevertheless, they're trying to make the argument that these ley lines have some kind of import in that they exist, I guess. Collins says there's these earth grids, which are these, like, power sites all around the world connected by lines of energy, which I think are the ley lines just sort of rebranded as earth grids. Anyway, all of which is to say, this furthers the argument, I guess, that Rudlow Manor is an important place. It was placed there because of its significance for these earth grids. Aliens have obviously been using it forever, hence Stonehenge. So why not, I guess, the Ministry of Defense use it too, is the thinking.
I feel like all this shit is put in there just to make the UFO stuff seem more credible. It's like ley lines and grids and stuff is just like so ridiculous that it's like, well, maybe the UFO stuff isn't so bad. I don't know.
I always do get tickled when they do an In the Field episode. It sort of reminds me of like a Tony Bourdain, Parts Unknown kind of a show. Like I want to see Tsoukalos when he's not, you know, doing the kind of breaking and entering type stuff. Like go around and be like, I'm trying the food, you know?
Yeah.
I'm trying the local sandwiches here. And then like figuring out how to draw a connection, like the shape of this sandwich is interesting. And I'm going to tell you why, because in the 1940s, there was a shape in the sky that, you know, go from there. Like everything gets tied back to some ancient astronaut chefs say, this is delicious.
I don't think there's any aliens in food episodes.
No, we talked about that, though. We talked about that being one we wanted to suggest because we were thinking about right. Like what kind of people could we invite on the show?
Such a good idea. I thought about it a second time.
Yeah.
All right.
So now we're getting into some of the famous moments in English UFO lore. They promised us that there was going to be a British Roswell, and we're getting close to it. David Wilcock shows up. So he tells a story about a couple in 1948 sees a UFO in Wiltshire. And what's significant about this is that the animation for it, you see this UFO fly up. He's describing how these two people see into the window of the UFO. It's always great when a UFO has a window, and they can actually see the eyes of the aliens. And so they show these two aliens who apparently weren't depicted otherwise or described in any way, because they just sort of, you know, you're always like, what species is that? And it sort of looked like a swamp thing. Like they're just kind of blobby.
Yeah.
Not reptilian, not gray.
As we've watched more and more of these ancient aliens, and I, no disrespect, but when David Wilcock, the guy they get to talk about stuff, I kind of feel like it just means there's nobody else who's willing to give credence to it. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of assume that what's going to follow is going to be kind of sketchy. And I felt like this was. Yeah. I felt like that attitude did me well.
Yeah. Game, set, and match. But I think the good news about, again, these later seasons where there's more of a budget is that they can sort of paper over that with cool animations or, you know, sending them into the field. Like there's always some way that you can kind of spice things up a little bit. And that takes us to London, 1955, where we finally get to see Britain's Roswell. The United States columnist Dorothy Kilgallen, very popular, obviously had work syndicated on both sides of the pond, as they say. So she's written a story based on ostensibly information coming from an intelligence agent about how the Brits have this UFO that had crashed in 1955 and was being stored somewhere. And so this was kind of a sensation, or at least supposedly it was. Now, unfortunately for Dorothy Kilgallen, she dies 10 years later under unusual circumstances.
I'm not sure how unusual they were.
How'd she die?
So she, her death was determined to have been caused by a combination of alcohol and barbiturates. No indication of violence or suicide. The overdose could well have been accidental.
Mm-hmm.
Not that mysterious.
She was investigating the Kennedy assassination, which helped fuel all kinds of conspiracy-related stuff, which they don't mention. I feel like of all the opportunities that this show has had to touch on conspiracies, I do feel like it's almost like JFK is the third rail. Like, it's just not.
Yeah.
That's like, we're not getting into that. That's too much.
The Kennedy thing is, you'd have to put aside a season to explain how the aliens were involved in that.
But she did cover some really wild stuff. I mean, again, if you wanted to have an episode about someone whose life may have been shaped by aliens pushing her toward exposés, she did sort of seem like she was in the right place at the right time. She covered FDR's first presidential campaign. She covered the trial in 1935 of Richard Hauptmann, who was the carpenter that was convicted, Toby, of killing the Lindbergh baby. And then, you know, listen, as a journalist, I'm here to tell you, they don't do a lot of this anymore. In 1936, she competed in a race around the world, two other reporters. Pretty cool.
Have you thought about doing any stunt journalism yourself?
I sort of think we're doing it right now.
There you go. I think if we were committing to it, we'd be storming Area 51 or
yeah,
something like that.
We'll get there. We're going to do that soon enough.
Yeah.
So interesting lady. But yeah, they love the idea that she died under circumstances that I guess are as mysterious as an overdose. So anyway, her story is that this UFO crashed in 1955. It was put on ice somewhere, according to the show. And then after World War II was brought to, that's right, Rudlow Manor, which is also called the British Area 51, which is, you know, you kind of feel like they just have to have everything renamed. You know, it's not like they can be like, well, our thing is called UFO Hinge or whatever.
The interesting thing I think there is that they found a UFO, but they're like, we're so busy with World War II, we can't really do much about it. And then they waited for another 10 years before they actually did something. It was like,
yeah,
it apparently was fairly low on the priority list.
And then we don't really hear much else about it. And that takes us to Wales in the years 1974. Again, we've now got a couple of UFOs that may or may not be in the possession of the British government, which they may or may not care about, and which may or may not have been reported by Dorothy Kilgallen, who may or may not have been killed for her connection to that, or the JFK assassination, or potentially fallout from the Lindbergh baby deferred 30-odd years. We don't know, but you know who doesn't care about that? That's right, Hugh Lloyd, a 14-year-old in 1974 in Wales, in the town of Cendreslow, Wales. And so once they told me Wales was coming up, I knew one thing, that we're going to have some great accents. And Hugh Lloyd did not disappoint.
And then we were all a bit stunned. They would never experienced anything like that before.
So this is a convoluted story, the ending of which makes no clearer because the government, as we will find out, decided just to like throw everything into the pot. But what happens is this small town sees a flash of light, according to Hugh, and it's apparently very important that they tell us he's 14 because I feel like they mentioned it a bunch of times.
They mentioned it a few times.
I don't know why. It's like he's 14 and there's nothing more credible than a 14-year-old boy.
Precocious.
You know, that's true. Mm-hmm. He's precocious.
If I saw a UFO crash, I would not be thinking about, like, is there a 14-year-old I can call to let know about this? It just seems like an odd thing, but I don't know. Maybe that's what you do.
You kind of do that when, like, your cable is out or something. You're like, call Hugh up. That kid knows that.
It's got it going on.
Not, hey, something fell out of the sky. We better call the local teenager who's probably otherwise just busy bursting his spots. which is what, as you know, the British call popping zits.
Yes.
Bursting your spots is, all right, anyway, that's great. So his neighbors are like, hey, Hugh, what's going on? He says, I don't know. We should tell you here that Hugh is then visited many years later in January or so of 2017 by Tsoukalos and Pope. And they're like drilling him on it. And he's got a nice place out there. Got some cute dogs, look like hunting dogs or whatever in cages. And they are asking him, what could it be? He says, you know, maybe it's an earthquake. And I'm like, why isn't it a meteorite? he offers that it was definitely not lamping, lamping being hunting rabbits and other things by lamplight, which is very charming. So now we have a cute animation of a spaceship streaking through the trees. You're looking up through the trees and here comes a spaceship. And they had a spider web there, which I thought was really artistically kind of elegant.
That's the way it goes in Wales. It's a lot of spider webs. Mm-hmm.
So a cop visits Hugh. Yep. Again, like this is the, Hugh is the go-to guy in the town of Centreslow, Wales. So the cop says it's a plane crash. As you know from the real Roswell, these early reports by enthusiastic cops or officials or whatever, they're always like, it's something. And then, you know, they're like, we don't know what it is. It might be this. And then the historical record corrects it. But nevertheless, conspiracists like to hang on to that first thing. Like, this dude just rolled up. He obviously knows something. No, he doesn't. Nevertheless, cop says it's a plane crash. Tsoukalos hangs on that. Then there's a whole long conversation with Hugh about how this cop came from Barmouth.
I remember our neighbour asking him, where are you based? And he said, Barmouth, which he'd be struggling to do it in an hour and a half today. But to that time, you know, you're talking 2 hours plus, maybe.
Right, and roughly what time did he turn up at the house?
25 minutes to 30 minutes after the incident.
Right, so there is no way that he could have got from Barmouth.
No way, not in a car, in a vehicle anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I liked that the question was, how long does it take to get to Barmouth? Which to me sounds like a drinking song all day long. How long does it take to get to Barmouth? 2 hours in pips. Anyway.
It's very nice.
Yeah. Well, we've all got a thing. So, okay. So this cop who's shown up out of nowhere, again, Hugh is the guy. He says, can I borrow your truck to go see what this thing that crashed is? So he loans him his Land Rover. And of course, Hugh being the fucking mayor of the town or whatever, has to go with him. So they go driving up into the hills. And now we're recreating that, right, with Pope and Tsoukalos. And that's where Pope says,
you know, one thing that struck me is this is a pretty difficult drive. So you've got to be pretty determined to get a whole bunch of people up here.
Yes, and for what purpose? Unless it's really something of importance.
Yeah.
And again, this is such a perfect example of Ancient Aliens logic. It's hard to get up here, therefore it must be something pretty important. Okay, I can sort of see that.
Well,
I mean, it is a road, right?
It's not really that hard. I mean, from the footage we saw, it's a dirt road. It's a one-lane dirt road.
Yeah, but even if it is hard to get up it, if they think they're investigating a plane crash, then yeah, yeah, all of these trucks and whatever are going to want to get up there.
I guess the real question is, why aren't there more?
And the other real question is, why are you bringing a 14-year-old to go investigate this thing? Okay, so they get to the top of the hill. They see this bright light that Hugh describes as glowing for 15 seconds. And as they're going down to check it out, the cop gets a call from his bosses. They say, stand down. And according to the narrative, the official explanation didn't include a plane crash or fox hunters. And this is where things do get a little weird. The official response, now again, I don't want to fuel a fight between the United States and England. We've been trading partners for a long time. Maybe those days are over, but we do get along. The official explanation for Roswell is a weather balloon. You can take it or leave it, but that's what it is. The explanation from the Brits for this thing was it was an earthquake and a meteorite breaking up in orbit. It was both things, they says, both things. What'd you think about that? Did you feel like that was a little bit of a hat on a hat?
Yeah, it's a weird coincidence, and it also seems like a weird thing that you would then like feel like you had to go and investigate. But as when we get to Rendlesham Forest, you'll see, you know, some of these things, in order for it to sort of be weird enough to fool people or to make people think that it's a UFO, sometimes it can't just be one thing, because you'd be like, oh, that was obviously a meteor streaking through the sky, or you know, that was an earthquake. But if you have the two together, it's like, what the fuck was that? And so, I mean, I think that's why it's somewhat, in my mind, like, it makes a little bit of sense, is that that's the kind of thing that actually fools people, is when you have two weird things like that happening at the same time. There's like, there's no earthly explanation. So I don't know, if you're of the mind that it probably was a UFO, then it does seem like kind of BS, but it's not like it's happening all the time. So like, is it possible that once every 50 years, there's a like shooting star and an earthquake at the same time? Like maybe.
You know what I say to that, Timmy?
I don't know.
How long does it take to get to Barbells? How long does it take to drive? And that brings us to Rendlesham Forest, the beating heart of this episode, which is odd because you would think it'd be Rudlow Manor. Turns out the mystery of Rudlow Manor is that it was Rendlesham Forest the whole time. Rendlesham Forest, 200 miles east of Rudlow Manor. And on December 26th, Boxing Day, 1980, something strange happened in the skies. Toby, you know something about this. Why don't you tell us? What the hell happened?
So I spent a few episodes on this, season two of Strange Arrivals. But essentially what happens is there's these two Air Force bases that are around Rendlesham Forest. One of them is Bentwaters. It's basically officially British, but at this time it's run by the Americans. So some guys who are on patrol see a light go down. Looks like it's crashing into the forest. I think maybe it's a small plane. These two guys end up going in to see what's going on, and they come across this sort of triangular UFO. According to the story, one guy gets kind of frozen, like sort of in suspended animation. The other guy, this guy Jim Peniston, kind of goes up to it and sees like hieroglyphics and stuff, and then he gets this weird like, this kind of came later. Like, this wasn't part of the original story, but he says he gets this weird, like, binary code download that he later writes down. So that's kind of the first night in a nutshell. The second night they talk about is actually something that probably wouldn't have even been thought about if it hadn't come in between the first and the third nights, which is that this woman who, again, is on patrol, whose name is Bonnie Tamplin, I think her car cuts out, and then like this green light kind of comes into her Jeep and she kind of freaks out, and that's about it for that night. The third night, there's more lights are seen in the sky. So this guy, Chuck Halt, brings a group of soldiers into Rendlesham Forest again. They have like night vision goggles and they're like trying to like see if that's going to help them see anything. Apparently at one point he looks at a lighthouse light is sweeping around and he like stares right at it with these night vision goggles, which apparently like make everything 40,000 times brighter. It just like blows his eyes out. I mean, not literally, but it's very, very bright.
Why didn't they do an animation of that?
The way they felt what was going on was that they were seeing UFOs, right? So he's not like it's a lighthouse. It's this really crazy thing. It looked like an eye. There's this whole thing where they go kind of racing out of the forest, across these fields, towards the water, actually, and this lighthouse. They're seeing all these lights in the sky. At one point, they think there's a beam that comes down. You know, while he's doing this, Chuck Halt has got a tape recorder, which he's switching on and off to kind of record what happens. So it's kind of interesting in that there is this, like, audio record of what he's seeing. And he's like, oh my God, is that a beam? And somebody else is like, yeah, that's a beam. You can kind of hear the stuff happening while it's going on.
Comes from the south. He's coming toward us now. Now we're observing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. This is unreal.
None of which is in the episode.
Yeah, they don't play this stuff in the episode. And then he writes a memo about what happened and that he wants to send like up the chain to be like, yeah, this is fucked up. Like there are these flying saucers and stuff. And basically nobody's interested. And that becomes like part of the cover up. They don't talk about this on Ancient Aliens either. So that's kind of in a nutshell. It's three nights. One night, not much happens. But the other two nights, there are these like kind of intense experiences that are had by military guys. And military guys are always kind of given this like they're trained observers. Like there's no way they could have been fooled. And so that's kind of the story that's given in this.
Did you find when you were looking into it that there was a lot of room for bunk? It sounds like these guys believed what they saw. Is it sort of like the same as the Navy pilots seeing the supposed UFOs while they were flying their fighter jets?
It's an interesting case in that sort of the explanation for it, which, you know, I don't know if it's universally accepted, kind of has these different elements to it. That includes that there was a satellite that fell out of the sky and an especially bright meteor that came down at the same time that they say they witnessed this thing go into the forest. And if you've seen like a really bright shooting star, and it goes behind something, like you don't really have a sense of how far away it is. So we have a place on a lake, and if you're out in the lake at night and you see a bright shooting star that's going down, it looks like it's going into the trees, right? So that was part of it. There are other things having to do with like not understanding how military equipment works. They brought a Geiger counter out to try and find if there was radiation. There were star conditions that they probably mistook. I mean, it's a whole kind of series of things that kind of adds up to, like I was saying before, a bunch of like little random things that taken by themselves wouldn't seem like very much. But the fact that it's like thing after thing after thing after thing, it kind of adds up into this like really weird mix that if you're going into it being like, man, that might have been a UFO, it seems likely. And these guys still, I mean, I talked to all three of the major people who are witnesses, and I think they pretty much sincerely believe it. At least two of them really do. You know, this is their story, right? This is their claim for fame. And, you know, at this point, they have different theories about what it actually was. The guy, Jim Peniston, who actually went up and kind of touched it and got closest to it and had this binary download, supposedly, he finds it in the back of this notebook like decades later, and he gets it decoded. And it's like this really cryptic message. It's like, eyes of your eyes, you know, year 8,000, something or other.
There's Exploration of Humanity, yeah. 666-8100, and then some coordinates.
Yeah.
Continuous for Planetary Advan, 3 question marks.
Yeah, don't know what those are.
Apparently the aliens are big texters, I guess. Then some coordinates, then a message, eyes of your eyes, looks like another coordinate, and then origin year 8100.
He thinks it's humans from 6,000 years in the future, and they're coming back to give us a message. And
coordinates for places like Belize, Sedona, Arizona. I love when Sedona's invoked.
Yeah, Sedona. I think the Great Pyramids.
The Nazca Lines.
Mm-hmm. When I talk to him, it's like, that's not even the thing. The real thing is the relationship between these places. I mean, it's just veers off into weirdness. But I think there's a suspicion that maybe that was stuff that the binary was added later. There's something like binary at one point was like 6 digits or 8 digits, and the code was actually given in 10 digits, which was something that wasn't the kind of binary they were using at the time. So you wouldn't have been able to decipher it at that time. You had to wait until the binary sort of protocols were changed in order for it to make sense. It's all kind of super sketchy.
Remember when binary was 6 digits.
Yeah, dude, way back
then. Make America great again.
So the other thing is that's kind of interesting is that David Clark is a folklorist and a university professor. He was looking at these files that got released by the British government, and he took a look at the Rendlesham file. He said it was fairly thick.
This is the files that they talked about at the beginning.
Right.
That were released to the archives.
But what he found was that it was like basically just like newspaper clippings and like letters to the editor and stuff. Like it wasn't really, it was more sort of like what was the press about Rendlesham rather than anything that was like the government was freaked out about it or concerned about it. And that sort of the reality of taking a look at the military response from both the British and the US and then the governmental response from the British is that they're like, not interested. Like this is not something that we need to really spend much time on. So it remains like one of those things that believers believe in it. And then there's this explanation. And I don't think there's, you know, you still see there's still stuff in the British press about it every once in a while will come up. And if you go to Rendlesham Forest now, there's a like a playground, I think. It's like a park with a playground that's got like a climbing thing that looks like the UFO as reported. I mean, it's just, it's turned into kind of like a tourist spot.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, any of it. The fact that most of the information is kind of blah and boring. The government's like, it doesn't matter. You guys can have it. The idea that the people who believe will find some way to make it significant. Ah, this stuff is not that useful. Let's disregard that. But these 18 missing files, that must be where the real juicy stuff is. Okay, sure. But, you know, this episode has taught us a few things, which is that even aliens can be deceived and can make mistakes. Their conclusion to the Rendlesham story is, as you said, these UFOs are flying around, shining supposedly beams of light into these bases where the soldiers are, and particularly into their weapons area, right? They make a big point of that. But the conclusion is they were looking for this UFO that supposedly had crashed a few days before. They were looking for the ship of their buddy, right? It went down around here somewhere. But then the show's like, what they didn't know is they were looking in the wrong place. Because Toby, guess where that UFO really was?
I'm thinking could have been under Rudlow Manor.
Could have been under Rudlow Manor. That was the mystery of Rudlow Manor. It was Rudlow Manor the whole time in the Agatha Christie sense. You always knew. This episode, Toby, rounds out. Again, it's important to keep in mind, sometimes the date of the episode doesn't really matter. But in this case, weird stuff was going on because they were recording it in January 2017. Some may remember that we had a bit of a presidential changeover at that point. So before that, the show reminds us that in October of 2016, WikiLeaks, of course, publishes the Podesta emails. Podesta was Hillary Clinton's chief of staff. And that, depending on who you ask, may have had something to do with why she didn't get elected. There wasn't anything in there particularly interesting other than, and this was acknowledged at the time, outside of Ancient Aliens, that Podesta was pretty interested in, if Hillary got elected, releasing the UFO files that the government had. She obviously doesn't get elected. But Obama, on his way out, is like, yeah, we'll make the CIA upload all of its files on UFOs. Does that. Nice mirror to what the Brits do, and supposedly inspired the Brits to do their own version of that. But of course, nothing interesting comes of any of that. So all the really secret stuff is still tucked away somewhere. Just like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, they put the Ark in a box and they wheel it into this warehouse. That's kind of the impression you get. Like somewhere in that 2.2 million square feet of tunnels, catacombs under Rudlow Manor, somewhere there's at least two UFOs, maybe some rabbits, and it's all run by a plucky 14-year-old kid named Hugh.
That's right. I do love that David Wilcock shows up at the end to say there are two confirmed cases of crashed UFOs brought to Rudlow.
Confirmed.
Again, nothing cited. No. Just kind of throws it out there.
After watching this episode, enjoying the field trip that Tsoukalos goes on with Pope and fun people he meets in the pubs, of course, Hugh Lloyd, the hero of this episode, a badass who can do no wrong. The real mystery of Rudlow Manor was the friends we made along the way.
So true. We got to get more listeners so we can go on field trips.
And as we go, we will sing together, "How long does it take to get to Barbados?" Toby, this has been More Like Ancient Phalians. I have been and will continue to be Brandon R. Reynolds.
Ditto for me, Toby Ball.
We'll see you next time.
Next time on More Like Ancient Phalians. The Sphinx, that most mysterious of giant carved creatures. What is going on with it, and how could it not be something to do with aliens? We wrestle with The Mysteries of the Sphinx, Season 9, Episode 2. We ponder why the Sphinx has such a pea head, meet a guy who is pretty sure the Sphinx is actually a dog, and contemplate a pyramid on Mars that might just guard an underground society. See you next week.
More Like Ancient Phalians is a Grab Bag collab production. Our producer is Heather Eagle Ears Wilson, and our music is by Nathan Reedy. And you know, you can find Phalians episodes and a whole bunch more early and ad-free over at www.grabbagcollab.com. Folks can subscribe directly to Phalians, or bundle a few shows, or just get them all. Go over there and check it out.